They outbreed everything in the forest and turn a beautiful wild place into a wasteland if left unchecked, so they were fair game in any season and at any age. As in the Collegium dining hall, and most inns for that matter, the space between the four fireplaces was filled with trestle tables and benches. These had been made as sturdily and heavily as possible, of whole and half logs, black with age and use and polished by thousands of behinds and hands. About half the tables were full, and servers moved among them with bowls of stew, platters of bread, wooden mugs and pitchers of beer. Most people, being hungry after a long day on the road, would opt for the easy and immediate, stew, bread, and beer, down in front of them in moments. Mags motioned to his son to follow and went to a quieter part of the room. Eventually, one of the servers noticed them and hurried over. It was a young lady with very red cheeks, wearing a practical set of trews, a baggy shirt, and a reasonably clean apron tied over it all.
"The stew is pig,"
she said before Mags could even open his mouth.
"Pig, carrots, onions, peas, beans. The bread is barley today. One bowl, one mug, one slice, 5 coppers. Butter's 1 copper extra. Cheese is 2 coppers extra. Apple pudding with last year's apples and honey is 1 copper extra.
Mags looked at his son. Perry nodded. The stew sounded better than anything he could put together out of the supplies in the wagon.
2 meals, butter and apple pudding.
Perry didn't get beer very often, but inn beer tended to be weak. Especially in an inn this large, you didn't want your customers actually getting intoxicated. The server held out her hand. Mags counted out coppers into it, and she bustled off and came back quickly with bowls of stew, a plate with 2 thick slices of bread on it, and a decent amount of butter on the side, and 2 mugs of thick beer. She dashed off again and returned with bowls of apple pudding, golden honey poured over the top.
"Keep your ears open," Mags murmured, as he dug his horn spoon out of his belt pouch and Perry did the same. "We're listening for anything about people going missing."
He honestly did not expect any information this far from Withern, but he never knew. This was the biggest inn out here, and if rumors were starting to fly, they'd end up here. Meanwhile, he was going to use his gift, sifting through the surface thoughts of those around him, allowing information to come to him passively. As he sifted, he discarded. Concern about profit, irritation at a partner's laziness, idle speculation about a server, not so idle speculation about a table full of women at the back of the room, and Mags didn't even have to sift through their thoughts to know why they were there. Although the weary traveler did not supply bed partners, the host made no objections to women plying their trade there. Having professionals on hand meant his staff didn't get assaulted, and food and drink and beds were all being paid for regardless.
"And if any of the professionals become a problem, out they go, and they'd better figure out some form of transportation, because it's a long way to the nearest village."
He didn't find anything at all out of the ordinary in his cursory sweep, so he finished his meal. The bread was surprisingly good for cheap barley bread, and since Perry had already finished his, he got up and headed out the door, knowing Perry would follow. The very last hint of sun vanished as they crossed the stable yard. The yard was considerably quieter now. The last of the free chickens were scrambling into a coop in the corner as one of the staff waited to close the door behind them. Another member of the staff walked around the yard lighting lamps. The boy watching their wagon sat up as he caught sight of them, jumped down and untied the horses. They were wearing their bridles again, and there was no sign of the feed bags. Mags nodded with approval. It also looked as if he'd given the Vanners and Pog a good brushing. He tossed the boy another copper. The lad snatched it out of the air, grinning, and led the horses slowly and carefully out into the yard, making sure the caravan was clear of any obstacles before handing over the reins.
"There's a good camping spot about 5 furlongs up the road," he offered. "Should be 4 or 5 wagons there already. Fresh water, though it's pretty well browsed over. Pays a copper."
Mags laughed and flipped over another copper. The lad loaded up the little porch at the rear of the caravan with as much hay as it would hold, tying it all down with a cord also made of hay. Pog, who was tied to the rear, looked at it longingly. Mags moved him to the front. He'd get his hay soon enough. They drove out into the twilight, and sure enough, before they'd gotten too far, they saw the lights of several wagons and a campfire. But Mags had not gotten where he was by being unsuspicious. He halted the horses for a moment and opened his mind to surface thoughts. It didn't take long for him to find a few things he didn't like.
Petty thieves in one of those caravans,
he said softly to his son.
I doubt the stable boy knows. He read Guileless to me. So what do we do?
Perry asked, looking up at his father.
We turn left instead of right, and after we cross the bridge, not before. Then we follow the stream. I'm sure we'll find a camping spot.
Actually, he was more than sure. He remembered a note on his map that said there was a Harold's Way station on a path following the stream to the south.
And we aren't going to go there to guard the other people because we don't want to look different.
Perry made that a statement rather than a question and nodded his head.
Papa, I got an idea. I can see if one of those caravanners has a dog and tell it to be alert.
Petty thieves were unlikely to have a dog around themselves.
That's a good plan,
he replied, wishing he could show Perry which of the caravanners were the thieves. Still, one night of unease with a fool dog barking every time someone went to take a piss was better than losing your goods.
They passed the camp quietly.
The caravanners were too busy passing around a bottle and enjoying themselves to notice the wagon moving at a walk passing their campsite. Mags was grateful for the darkness and the big fire they'd built, which effectively blinded them to everything outside the circle of caravans. As they crossed the bridge, hoofbeats muffled by a layer of mud on it, Mags spotted the path and turned the horses down it. Pog didn't like having brush hitting his flank, but fortunately, he only showed his objection by tossing his head. Insects sang loudly to their right, and frogs leaped into the stream with alarm to their left.
I'm beginning to wonder if we should get a dog. It would be child's play for you to train it.
I could do that,
Perry agreed eagerly.
That'd mean we wouldn't have to keep a watch at night. Not a puppy. I wish we'd thought of that before we left. We could have gotten one of Lady Dia's mastiffs.
Damn if I don't wish the same,
Mags said with chagrin, thinking of the size of those mastiffs and how it would be worth sharing the caravan with a dog big enough to take up the whole of one of the bunks for the sake of protection.
And what am I, an ornamental doorstop?
Mags laughed aloud, and Perry looked at him with that little smirk that told him his son knew Dallin had made him laugh. And just at that point, the moon rose above the trees, flooding the clearing and the way station with light. Perry bounced on the seat.
This is a way station,
he exclaimed.
Yes, it is, and we won't be using it or touching the supplies, Mags cautioned him. Officially, I am not a herald, and we need to make a habit of acting like traitors.
Dallin trotted into the clearing as soon as the caravan had gotten off the path and pulled up next to the way station.
Can I look inside?
Perry begged.
Be my guest. It's nothing special, though.
Mags hopped down off the box and cut the hay string, tying the hay onto the porch, letting it all fall to the ground. He ran the tie-out rope between the porch rail and a tree right at the waterline, then unharnessed Pog and the Vanners, slipping on simple hackamore so they could eat, and put them on the tie-out. They could choose between hay and the lush, overgrown grass and water themselves at their leisure. Perry came out of the way station, shutting the door carefully behind himself, in time to take over rubbing down the horses so Mags could attend to Dallin. Dallin, of course, didn't need to be tied out, and Dallin, not having had the benefit of a feed bag at the inn, got a ration of grain poured out for him away from the others. Mags stripped to his bare skin and gave himself a quick wash in the stream. After hesitating a moment, Perry did the same. The water was quite cold, but Perry didn't complain. And he got the water bucket and filled the water barrel on the back of the caravan without being asked.
So, did they have a dog?
Mags asked, sloshing clean water over himself after giving himself a good scrub.
Yes, and I don't think the thieves are going to have a good night of it. They really didn't like any of the other people camping, so he'll be barking every time one of them moves.
Perry jumped to the bank and toweled himself off vigorously. Mags did the same, and they both hurried back to the caravan. Biting insects had already discovered them, and Mags was not eager to find himself a mass of welts in the morning. Perry dove straight into his cubby bed. Mags opened all the windows and made sure the fine linen window guards, made of the same material flour sieves were made of, were all fastened securely in place before taking to his own bed.
Are we going to watch the people in the inn?
Perry's voice came, muffled, from beneath him.
As long as you can stay awake, yes, please. Now will be the time, when stronger drink comes out, and people huddle closer together against the darkness when odd stories will be told. Just tell me in the morning if anything crops up.
Yes, sir,
came the polite reply, and then attentive silence. The frogs came back and began to croak, the sounds of equine jaws munching and tearing at grass, and the frog and insect calls were all that broke the evening quiet. Mags yawned, wondering if he should be sifting through the thoughts of those people in the campsite, or whether he could just sleep.
Better safe than sorry. Besides, they might know something.
But he discovered that they were already abed. Well, the honest ones were. The thieves, predictably, they only owned what they could carry on their backs, were bedded down next to the fire where the smoke would keep insects away, pretending to sleep, waiting for a chance to go through the storage compartments under the caravans. Except that the dog, a big, rangy mongrel, was watching them on the other side of the fire, and every time they moved a little, its head came up off its paws and it stared holes in them. Mags smothered a chuckle, and he let his mind drift back to the inn. But the stories around the tables tonight were all cheerful ones. No mysterious disappearances, no rumors of kidnappings. So whatever was going on, and the closer they got to Harold Arvel, the more certain he became that the old man was not starting at Shadows, news of it hadn't made its way here. But he could think of a very good reason why it might not have. Traders of the sort that he and Perry were imitating, prosperous ones with a decent equipage, had regular routes, like a Harold's or Healer's circuit. If they went missing, they'd be missed. But there were plenty more people who were desperate enough to take their chances out there on the fringes who did not have a regular route. Instead, they made their way like vagabonds, trading what little they had, hoping to kill or find or trade for something worth a lot of money back in civilized lands. If someone like that vanished, who would know? And there were always people who ran off, or were run off, from their villages. Once again, unless you were keeping track of comings and goings, and noticed that the goings did not match up with the comings, there would be no chance you'd realize someone hadn't arrived where they intended to go. Was that what Arvel had been trying to convey in his letters? When pressed, Laurel had admitted that Arvel's reports had never been particularly good, and he struggled with the written word. And when he was just reporting on routine matters like village problems on his circuit, it had never been an issue. But if there was something going on that was beyond his ability to articulate, Mags could only imagine his frustration.
"And all this is just speculation," he reminded himself. "We'll see what we'll see. And meanwhile, this trip is doing good things for Perry. That is reason enough for it."
5. Pog trotted along a road that was barely big enough for the caravan, thick forest on either side, with Perry riding easily in the saddle. He hadn't admitted it to his father, but part of the reason why he'd driven as much as he had was because he had discovered that riding for a long time had made him saddle sore. He'd decided to make a virtue out of necessity by training the vanners while he built up to riding for Candlemarks at a time. He had assumed that being able to scamper over rooftops would have used every single muscle in his body, but evidently riding used some he hadn't been aware of until an entire morning in the saddle. At this point, the vanners were trained to work without bits, and he could finally ride for most of the day without needing assistance out of the saddle. Perry had quite literally never seen forest this old or this impenetrable, or at least it seemed impenetrable from the road. His father assured him that the thick undergrowth only persisted for a length or two away from the road, and that only the break in the canopy above the roadway allowed such thick bushes and luxuriant weeds to thrive. He wasn't willing to put that to the test. He was at this moment acutely aware of just how much of a city boy he was. This forest, this road, was unnerving. The trees loomed over the road, at times enclosing them in a green tunnel, and when the sky was overcast, it was a gloomy green tunnel. He didn't recognize most of the calls and sounds out there. He couldn't even tell whether some of the sounds came from a bird or a beast. He found himself encountering utterly unfamiliar minds when he used his gift. One good thing, though, he had not yet encountered an animal or a bird he couldn't coax into cooperating with him, but the wildness, the fierceness of some of those minds had taken him aback. and so far he hadn't even encountered a single one of the famed Pelagir beasts, just ordinary things like wolves and wild boar. Right now he was very, very glad of that. The wolves weren't that bad, but the wild boar? That thing was vicious. The road was, of course, not paved. Not this far away from the capital. And in fact, it saw so little traffic that there were weeds and grass growing between the parallel wheel tracks. The banner's hoofbeats were more muffled than he was used to hearing. Dolan was somewhere farther ahead, scouting. They should be meeting with Harold Arvel soon, according to what his father had said this morning, but so far, there had been no sign of him. And just as he thought that, they rounded a gentle curve in the road, and there he was. Or at least, there were two side-by-side bits of white, glowing against the green of the forest in the far distance. "Ah, there's Arvel," Mags said, needlessly, but he did not cluck to the horses to speed them up. "He already knows we're supposed to be traders who are old friends of his family, and he'll have told everyone in Withern that. So we'll be sleeping in real beds tonight, and we'll be staying in his house as his guests."
"I don't mind the bunks," Perry replied. "It's the sun I don't much like. It's up way too early for me," his father laughed.
Slowly, the two parties approached each other, and as soon as Harold Arvel was near enough to make out clearly, well, Perry had to work very hard not to stare, because he had never seen a Harold who looked quite like Arvel. To begin with, every piece of his uniform looked as if it had been made for someone else. The fit was... well, there was no fit. It all hung oddly on him. Arvel's gray hair looked like an unmade bed, all tousled. His beard and mustache were short and yet somehow scraggly. Maybe it was because both were sparse and looked as if he had grown them more to avoid having to shave than because he wanted them. And he slouched. He carried himself as if he was trying not to be noticed. And yet, there was a huge grin plastered on his face, a grin of welcome in which there was quite a bit of relief.
"When they said Harold Max was coming, I thought they were spinning me a tale to shut me up, but here you are," Arvel exclaimed gleefully. "Laurel finally took me seriously."
Perry gave Pog the signal to trot forward, holding out his hand. "Laurel finally came to my father. And father convinced her, I think. Hela, I'm Perry." Arvel seized his hand and gave it a slightly over-enthusiastic shake.
"I'm Arvel, about there. You knew that."
He had an odd voice, higher than Perry would have expected from someone as tall as he was, and a little hoarse, with a self-deprecating manner that would have seemed forced on anyone else.
"This is Pallas, and this..."
Something easily the size of one of Dia's biggest mastiffs came trotting stiffly from around the other side of Dalin.
A Kyrie!
Quickly, before they could react poorly to the strange beast, he put calming thoughts into Pog's, Lily's, and Daisy's minds. Just in time, too. Pog had tossed up his head, and he snorted in alarm before Perry was able to calm him. It was instantly recognizable from the drawing that Perry had studied. Head very wolf-like, body very cat-like, with an arching back, long, curved, shaggy tail, dark gray fur a little longer than a wolf's. It had a very white muzzle, and between that and the way the Kyrie moved, it was probably as old as Arvel. Perry reached for its mind. "Hello?" he said tentatively. The Kyrie's jaw fell open, and it sat down right there in the middle of the road in surprise.
"Why? Hello, youngling. You can speak with me. How absolutely delightful. What a wonderful surprise."
"My gift is animal mind speech," he explained,
then thought, belatedly, that the Kyrie might find being taken for an animal a little insulting. But it didn't.
"Well, this truly is a pleasant surprise indeed. I'm rather glad no one told us you had such a gift. It makes the surprise even better. I am Ryu, young one. Pleased to meet you, Perry. That would be a nickname for Peregrine, surely, rather than your parents naming you for a pear wine?"
He had to laugh at that, but neither Arvel nor his father noticed. They were already deep in conversation as the Vanners waited patiently for the signal to move on. While he and Ryu were talking obliviously away, Arvel and his father were getting acquainted, so he felt perfectly free to ignore the other Harold and concentrate on the Kyrie without being rude.
It is Peregrine. My father is Mags. I hope we can either solve Arvel's problem for him or put his mind at ease by proving there actually is no problem.
The novelty of having an actual mental conversation with another creature was just amazing. He found himself grinning like a right fool over it.
I hope you can solve it too, my fine youngling,
gave the sober reply.
Because I would stake my tail on it. My bondmate is not mistaken. There is something out past our village that is very, very wrong, and the fact that we have not been able to trace it to its lair is not a good sign. Of course, part of that is our age.
The Kairi uttered a gusty sigh.
We are no longer fit for much besides a gentle jog down the road to meet with visitors, but most of it, I fear, is more sinister than that.
Perry said nothing, just projected an air of waiting for the Kairi to finish.
I fear,
it said after an appropriate pause,
that whatever is making innocence vanish, it is clever enough to completely overcome Arvel's luck, and that would have to be diabolically clever indeed.
Well,
Arvel said as they turned off the road,
here's my house.
Perry's eyes nearly popped out of his head. He'd expected a neat little cottage, or perhaps even a real house with an extra bedroom or two that he and his father would use. He hadn't expected something the size of a highborn city manor. It was 3 stories tall. Most inns out here weren't that big. It must have had 6 or 8 bedrooms besides the one Arvel used, maybe more. Like the Weary Traveler, it was built of pale stone with a slate roof, and it looked as if someone had basically copied the design of one of its 3 living wings with a detached stone stable in the rear. The Kairi clearly saw his shock and surprise.
Arvel's parents were quite wealthy,
the beast told him.
They were also quite proud of him becoming a herald and left him a substantial sum on their passing. He invested it into this home, building it here for when he was too old for riding a circuit anymore.
But why not live at the Collegium?
Perry wanted to know.
Because of me. There are those who would look askance at the Kairi in Haven. Here they know, and he's useful. People come to him to solve problems, and we can play host to any heralds, healers, or bards that come along this way, as well as the local guard patrol on this road. There's generally someone here, most of the time. Journeyman bards even spend the winter.
By this time, they had come around the side of the substantial building to the stable, which was just as stoutly constructed as the house itself. There was room for 10 ordinary horses and loose boxes suitable for 4 companions. Perry put Pog up in the first one, untacked and brushed him down, then got the vanners as soon as his father had backed the caravan into place. Both vanners perked their ears upon seeing where they were being taken, and Lily gave a snort of approval. Meanwhile, his father took care of Dallin, who also looked entirely well pleased with his situation. Arvel put Pellis up in the box next to Dallin.
Who's hungry?
He asked brightly, throwing Pellis's saddle over the place for it on the side of the stall.
I know I am!
Without waiting for an answer, he led the way in through a rear door, which proved to lead to a kitchen. And without a pause, he went to the pantry on the right and emerged with bread, butter, cheese, ham, and pickles.
Help yourselves,
he said as he proceeded to make himself a plateful, then a second that he placed on the floor for Ryu. The Kairi lay down to eat it, probably because his neck was stiff. Perry was always willing to eat, so he filled a plate for himself. His father waited to go last and buttered a little bread and added some cheese, probably more for politeness' sake than anything else. They all sat down on stools around the big table in the center of the kitchen. There was a pitcher of water and pottery mugs next to it in the middle, and Perry poured them all water.
I don't have a fancy dining room,
Arvel explained around bites.
Never liked them. Anybody that's too fancy to eat in the kitchen's no one I want to be around. Kitchen's warmer in the winter anyway, and food comes hot to the table.
Perry and his father both nodded. There was sense in that.
I've got a room where everyone can sit around the fire, the kitchen, and the bathing room. Everything else is bedrooms or storerooms. I'm not quite the Herald resupply station, but I come close.
Mags chuckled.
So rather than you going to the Collegium comes to you? That's brilliant, Orville.
The old man blushed.
I don't know about that, Mags. I just like being useful, even if we can't go racketing all over the countryside anymore. And sometimes, when she's got people she doesn't want to leave in their cottages, the healer Ivy brings them to me, and I put them up until they're well enough to go home.
When Perry had first heard about this old man, he had felt, well, kind of sorry for him. He pictured the old Harold living alone, except for the Kyrie, in a tiny little cottage like a hermit. But he could not have been more wrong. Arvel was clearly in the heart of Wyvern, even though he lived on the edge of it, with friends and ears everywhere.
So all these people coming and going, is that how you began coming to the conclusion there was something wrong out here?
Mags asked. Arvel nodded.
It's hard to explain on paper,
he replied awkwardly.
I'm sorry if I didn't do it so good. But, you know, I'd hear that some no-good girl ran off with a boy, and instead of hearing that they turned up to live in Bylis or Raznik and getting to listen to the old hens cluck about how the people there are no better than they should be and that water finds its own level, that'd mean nothing. And people would forget about them. Or one of those pack peddlers would turn up, leave, and there'd never be another word about him. So about a year ago, I started writing down all the people in the last few years that seemed to have fallen down a hole and started asking about them. And all I got was a lot of nothing. I put all that in my report to Laurel, but all she said was that people go missing all the time out here, but not so many.
He finished, the last word sounding like a cry of despair.
That's because Laurel was looking at the records of people who were reported missing, Mags said thoughtfully. Not the ones that you think went missing. I'd like to have a look at your list. Not now, he cautioned when Arvel looked as though he was going to leap to his feet. Nothing we can do in a couple candle marks is going to make a bit of difference one way or the other. But in the morning, when we can both put our heads together over this.
I hope your father intends to use mind speech to look at Arvel's thoughts,
Ryu put in thoughtfully, looking up at Perry.
Arvel's not the most articulate of the fearsome foursome.
The who?
Arvel, Harold Laurel, Harold Alma, and Harold Rod,
Ryu clarified.
That's what they called themselves. The fearsome foursome. It was rather amusing at the time. Anyway, Arvel is kind and clever in his own way, and absolutely dogged when he's got a job in front of him. But not terribly articulate. He's worse on paper.
It occurred to Perry that the one thing that had been conspicuously absent in the tally of rooms was a library.
So he doesn't read either?
That's why we like having bards here for the winter. Obviously, I can't read, or I'd read to him.
The Kyrie uttered a small sigh.
I tried to help him with his letters to Laurel, but he got muddled anyway.
I'll tell my father to ask if he can use mind speech, Perry promised.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, as they talked, Arvel had been telling his father about the village and about the Pelagir Hills, which Wyvern literally sat on the edge of. There had even been a Hawkbrother enclave not more than two or three candle marks away when Arvel had first gotten the circuit that included Wyvern, but they were long gone. They'd left in the third year he'd been stationed out here.
Normally heralds move around so villagers don't get too used to them, Mags observed. Why do they keep you out here?
Well, there's my luck, for one thing, Arvel explained. There's still plenty of weird stuff out here, and my luck kept me alive and pretty much unhurt. Then there's the people. They weren't used to heralds out here. They were really suspicious about strangers, so once they got used to me, they told Haven they didn't want anyone else.
He shrugged.
And I like this place. And it's close enough for Ryu to visit his relatives, or for them to visit him.
Wait, relatives? Mag said, blinking.
There's three kinds of Kyrie, Papa,
Perry interjected politely, when it looked as though Arvel was going to stumble over his explanation.
Male, female, and neuter. The neuter ones are kind of pack historians, and when there are several of them in a pack, some of them go out and collect history and stories from outside the pack territory.
Exactly, said Arvel with relief. So every so often, One of Ryu's relatives comes here to collect stories, or when we were both younger, he'd go to them. In fact, that's where I got information about some other missing people. Ryu's pack collects things like that.
Not entirely accurate, but close enough, Ryu observed to Perry.
Arvel finally stopped eating, but only when all the food he had brought out was gone. Perry was amazed. He had never seen anyone eat that much food in one sitting, and Arvel was so lanky, it looked as if he hardly ever ate at all.
All right,
Arvel said with a glance out the kitchen window, where the light was definitely taking on a darker gold tinge.
It's almost sunset, and you were traveling all day. Let's get your things and move them into bedrooms. Right next to the bathing room, good?
Excellent, Mag said with a smile. We both need a bath.
Rod built me this terrific system with a cistern and stuff. It's all black on the outside, so the sun warms it up.
Arvel nattered on as they went back outside to where the wagon had been parked. Long shadows stretched across the field, and the air was already appreciably cooler and damper. It took about 3 trips to get all their personal belongings out of the wagon and to their rooms. The rooms weren't big, just about the size of a room at the Collegium, but the bed was extremely comfortable, and the windows had shutters and linen inserts, so you could open them to let the breeze in while still keeping the bugs out. Mags was still talking to Arvel when Perry checked the bathing room. He decided that he was going to get a bath while his father was occupied. There was a big metal tub with a hole in the floor of it, and a plug made of a thick disc of wax. It had 2 hand pumps, one with a blue handle and one with a red handle. Perry fitted the wax disc over the hole and molded it in place, then began pumping. The bathing rooms in the Collegium and the palace had water heated in big copper boilers that needed special attendants to keep them hot and make sure nothing went wrong with them. Big inns and community bathhouses had the same. Perry could easily see why that wouldn't work here. If Harold Arvel had any servants, they didn't seem to be around now, and it would be pretty foolish to keep a servant on just to make sure there was hot water for one man. But if Harold Rod had figured out a way to let the sun heat up bathwater, well, that would be easier. All you'd have to do would be keep the cistern topped up. But even if it went dry, there wouldn't be a problem. He stripped down and eased into the tub. He'd really missed hot baths. Bathing in cold streams wasn't too bad, but it wasn't all that good either. The water was comfortably hot. It felt fantastic and made him very sleepy. By the time he slipped on a clean nightshirt and got to his room, he decided to put his things away later, and he got straight into his bed. It was even more comfortable to lie in than to sit on. It was a lovely twilight out there, and the sounds of insects and wild things were comfortably farther away than they were in the caravan. I'm gonna like it here, he thought contentedly, and he listened to the summer night until everything faded away. The adults let him wake up on his own, which he thought was very nice of them. It wasn't dawn when he finally opened his eyes, but it wasn't mid-morning yet either. And he smelled bacon. Probably that was what had woken him. His stomach, although it had been full when he went to bed, now registered a complaint with him at that savory aroma. He scrambled into clothing and headed for the kitchen. There were 3 people there. Arvel, his father, and a sturdy-looking woman enveloped in a huge apron who was using a spatula to transfer flat cakes to their plates.
Perry!
Arvel greeted him.
Mrs. Weaver was just asking when you were going to wake up.
I said I thought the bacon smell was good enough to wake the dead, so I was surprised when he wasn't here already,
Mrs. Weaver replied, bending down to add a pair of flat cakes to the bowl Ryu was eating from under the table.
Only 2 for you, old man. Flat cakes aren't that healthy for puppies.
Asram,
Ryu replied, and he waited while she put a dollop of honey on his cakes. Perry scrambled into the chair with an empty plate in front of it and was soon feasting on bacon, flat cakes, and honey while Mrs. Weaver dished up a 2nd bowl of chopped meat for Ryu and put it down for him. Mrs. Weaver, he soon gathered, lived in Withern, where her husband was, predictably enough, a weaver. She did almost all of Arvel's cooking for him, while her 2 nieces cleaned his house and a nephew took care of outside work and chopped wood. Withern boasted a miller, a blacksmith, and a baker, she told Perry proudly. He wasn't sure why that made her proud, but he nodded enthusiastically and kept his mouth full so he didn't have to betray his ignorance. She and Arvel kept up a conversation concerning local people, none of which was terribly interesting, but he listened carefully to all of it, because, as he had learned from Lord Jorthon, sometimes the key to a problem lay in the most trivial of details you might overhear. By the time he was stuffed, she had finished cleaning the kitchen and took her leave. She left behind two pies baking slowly in the oven built into the hearth, admonishing Ryu to
keep a nose on them and tell Arvel when they're done,
and a pot of soup simmering on the hearth. The pies he gathered were for dinner, and the soup for supper. Then she bustled off, passing two giggling girls who slipped by her in the doorway, ogled his father, looked at him and dismissed him with a glance, and gave a respectful greeting to Arvel.
I need to go put my stuff away, he said, not wanting those strange girls to start poking through his things.
Without waiting for an answer, he made an awkward little bow to Arvel and his father and skipped for his room.
Put your dirty clothing in the basket by the door,
Arvel called after him. He got to his room just in time. The girls had made up his bed, and one of them had a hand on the box he'd brought that contained some of his equipment.
I can take care of that, he said from the door, startling them so that one jumped and the other squeaked.
If you say so,
said the one who had squeaked, while the other sniffed and flounced past him with her nose in the air. They looked very alike, with brown hair, brown eyes, and dusky skin. In fact, they looked like much younger versions of Mrs. Weaver. He picked up his box and put it on the bed, keeping one hand on it and staring at the remaining girl until she turned to leave.
Keep your secrets then, little boy,
she said over her shoulder.
You won't have anything in there I ain't seen before 100 times.
Perry almost laughed then, thinking about the things, some of them deadly, that he'd stowed in that case. But it wouldn't do to break character with the peddler's son he was supposed to be. Let them think him a little boy. It did him no harm and might lead to them being free with their words around him. Not that he thought Arvel didn't have his finger on the pulse of Withern. Arvel might not be the most articulate fellow around, but he was a herald, trained, seasoned, and with not only a companion, but also Ryu to help him. But with the presence of two very nosy girls allowed to rummage unchecked through Arvel's house as they cleaned, he decided it would not do to unpack the things in his special box, nor did he dare to leave it unlocked. So when he opened it, it was only to extract the key, which he hung on a strong but slender steel chain around his neck, then lock it again and shove it under the bed. Then he went through the piles of personal things and clothing he'd left against the wall last night and stowed it all away in the wardrobe and chest next to it, provided for the purpose. There was a second chest at the foot of the bed, but it was already full of linens and extra blankets. When he finished putting everything away and wandered back to the main part of the house, neither Arvel nor his father were anywhere about. After a moment, he decided to stroll into Withern, which must be farther up the road. He could make use of his gift among the animals in the village and see what he could learn. It turned out that the village would have been within easy sight of Arvel's home if a heavy growth of trees had not blocked the view. The village was about the same size as dozens of nearly identical villages that they had already passed. That is, it was ridiculously small by his standards. The only difference between Withern and all the other tiny villages they had gone through was that Withern was guarded by a palisade of logs. There was no guard at the gate, however, and careful, if covert, examination of the ground at the foot of the open gate told him it hadn't been moved in quite a long time. So whatever was out there that the villagers had needed to guard against wasn't there anymore. Or they didn't think it was. The road did not go through the village. Instead, a lane broke off from the road, passed through the gate, and dead-ended in an open area with a well in the middle of the village. In a bigger place, he supposed this would have been a village square, but this village was too small to need one. He went just inside the gate and leaned his back against the palisade, taking inventory. There were about 2 dozen cottages and one larger house. Around the well were the blacksmith, the baker, identified by the big ovens outside his house, and that one large building about half the size of Arvel's house. This would probably be where the village leader lived, since the wealthiest man in the village was generally also the de facto leader.
You have to respect Arvel's delicacy in not moving into the village and building his home there, observed Ryu.
Perry glanced down into his side. While he had been looking over the village,
Ryu had come up silently behind him. I can see where some people might have gotten offended, and the rest might have wanted him to be the village leader, Perry observed.
Very good. Exactly so. And, of course, he wanted neither. So he explained to everyone that the heralds had asked him to build something big enough that he could serve as a sort of guardhouse for the guard patrol hereabouts, and he never let on that playing host to the guard had been his idea.
Is there a tavern or inn here? That was generally the best place to gather information.
No. The baker sells beer and lets people gather in the main room of his house to drink it. That's the closest thing we have to a tavern.
Ryu made a laughing sound in the back of his throat at Perry's surprise.
That's how things usually are in a village this small. Whoever brews the best beer ties a grain sheaf over their door, which tells people that he also sells beer and lets people come inside to gather and drink it. In summer, folks usually gather outside to drink, though.
In fact, now that he was looking, Perry spotted two torch holders and the remains of a couple of burned-out torches on either side of the baker's door.
That is why no one thought anything about it when Arvel said he was building a quasi-guardhouse. People have been grumbling for some time that there was no guardhouse nearer than 2 days' walk. I don't think there are more than 3 riding horses in this entire village. Most plowing is done by ox, and families go in together, 3 and 4 at a time, for a cart horse and cart.
Perry pondered all this for a while, leaning against the gate. There wasn't a single person visible, but he could certainly hear people at work. I'm thinking I won't find out much about Arvel's problem here.
You would be correct,
Ryu agreed.
No. What we are going to have to do is go out into the wilds.
Perry thought about that, and he grinned. Well, he had wanted to learn new things. This was going to be very new. 6.
Of course, he couldn't just get Pog and go riding out into the wilderness on his own. First, that would be stupid. Second, his father would murder him for wandering off without warning, or a plan, or any idea of what he was doing. And third, that would be incredibly stupid. So instead, after a glance at Ryu, he strolled into the village just to have a further look around. As luck would have it, the baker came out to check on his ovens at just that moment and spotted him. It was pretty obvious he had to be the baker. Aside from the fact he'd come out of what Perry had already figured was the baker's house, he was wrapped up in a huge white apron and had flour on his sleeves.
Oh, boy!
The man hailed him.
You're the trader's lad what stand with our Arvel, eh?
Yes, sir, I am, Perry replied, trying not to smile at our Arvel, as if the herald were village property. My name is Perry, sir, and my father is Mags.
Well, good. The women folk have been looking forward to seeing what you brought. And in the meantime, you can take Arvel's order so I don't have to send my boy.
Seeing as he had been volunteered, Perry gave in with a good grace and waited while the baker checked his ovens. Then when the man beckoned to him, he followed him inside the house. Definitely a house. It was a little too big to be a cottage. Once there, the baker loaded a grass basket with a meat pie and 3 fresh loaves, and then topped the load off with 12 seed cakes, each wrapped in a woven grass square. The basket was crudely made and probably wouldn't last past getting it back to Arvel's house, but then, that was all it was needed for.
If I'd known I was going to be dragooned into being a delivery boy, I'd have brought a bag or a box from the kitchen, he thought with some amusement.
As he packed up the foodstuffs, the baker examined his own handiwork carefully. One of the seed cakes somehow was defective, and the baker insisted Perry eat it. 2 more were just as defective and were gulped down by Ryu.
Do I need to pay you, sir?
Perry asked, carefully picking up the packed basket and waiting for the answer.
Our Arvel pays by the moon, the baker said. Off with you. The basket won't last forever.
So he trudged back to Arvel's home, escorted by Ryu and trailing the aroma of fresh-baked bread. Mrs. Weaver was back in the kitchen when Ryu pulled the latch string with his teeth and shouldered the door open so Perry didn't have to juggle the basket to get inside. She turned as he entered and smiled at him.
Put that basket in the pantry. There's a good lad. Is there a meat pie in there?
Yes'm, Perry replied, doing as he was told.
Good. He got it in on the first baking. That'll be your supper then, with the soup. Your pa'll be in the stable with our Arvel.
She went back to whatever it was she was chopping, and Perry took the hint, leaving the same way he'd come in. Arvel and his father were looking over the vanners, with Arvel making some pretty intelligent conversation about the breed.
So, how did you like Withern? Mags called as Perry and Ryu came through the stable door.
It's small. He had kept half his seed cake back, and he gave it to Dalin. The baker is nice.
There never was much trouble out of Withern, Arvel noted. That's why I decided to move here. You're going to have to look farther away for the trouble. North and west.
Mags nodded.
Well, first, we had better establish ourselves as genuine traders before we go off. I told Mrs. Weaver we'd be open for business tomorrow morning. So let's go get the trade goods out of storage and ready for display.
All of the trade goods were held in locked compartments under the caravan. Perry took the side of the wagon that was almost against the wall since he was the smallest. Inside the compartments were paper-wrapped bundles of ribbons, woven trim, hanks of colored thread and hanks of colored chira wool, spun finer than any village spinster could ever manage. Then there were the beads, hanks of thread on which tiny, glittering glass beads were strung, strings of larger glass beads, strings of copper, brass, and pewter beads, strings of semi-precious stone beads, so many different kinds it made his head spin. Last of all were two bolts of chira wool cloth and a few bolts of linen much more finely woven than any village loom could manage, the sort of thing to make a bridal veil or a fine shawl from. Over on the side that Arvel and Perry's father were working on were the display tables for all these goods, ingenious things that could be taken apart and put back together again within a half a candle mark.
Papa, he called. Should we just set everything out tonight?
No,
came the answer from the other side of the caravan.
Just unload everything from the boxes into the caravan. There are too many creatures around here that are attracted to shiny things. We'll set up in the morning.
The bead boxes were small but astonishingly heavy for their size. Perry put the bolts of fabric into his father's bed, along with the boxes of colored thread. Then the bead boxes went onto the bunks on either side of the caravan. He didn't drop the upper bunks down to use. He knew they could support a grown adult, but he didn't want to trust the weight of the beads to them. His father came to help him with the last of the load, locking the door of the caravan behind them.
Tomorrow we'll find out just what sort of trade we can expect from a little village like this, he told Perry, and he made sure the lock was secure. I have a notion of loading packs on the vanners and taking them out instead of packing up the entire caravan and sniffing for trouble. I think we might make a better target with just us and two horses.
That's a good idea, Arvel agreed. That's a real good idea.
He opened the door for them and sniffed. There was a rich aroma of gravy in the air.
I smell meat pie, he said happily.
Perry exchanged a look with his father, and Perry tried not to chuckle. As soon as the sun was up, Mags rousted Perry out of his dreams, and with barely enough time to wolf down some eggs and buttered bread, he chivied him out to the caravan to set everything up.
I'll set the prices at first, Mags told him as he carefully put each item in its proper place. But I want you to listen and learn them as quickly as you can. If anyone brings anything to trade, though, I'm the only one who can make a deal.
Yes, sir, Perry nodded. Do you think anyone will trade?
Oh, they'll want to. Real coin is scarce out here. I fancy the only time they ever see it is when Arvel pays for something, or the local guard patrol comes through. The question is whether they have something a real trader would actually want.
Because we can't act out of character from a real trader, Perry nodded.
He furrowed his brow.
Are they actually going to have something we want?
Mags shrugged.
Strange things come out of here. They might. Arvel told me the traders don't come here that often, and when they do, they are generally traveling with no more than they can carry on a single mule.
No more than a sixth of their goods were on the tables, but that was because Mags only put out one of each item. The rest were still in the caravan, and their first customer was Mrs. Weaver. As soon as she finished her morning work, she came bustling out of the kitchen door with a bright and expectant expression on her face and she clasped her hands with pleasure when she saw the colorful display.
"Oh, I had no idea you lads had all this in your wagon," she exclaimed,
and she bent over the table of colored threads and trim.
"So many pretty things," she added,
looking at everything with a sort of hunger. Mags chuckled and plucked a bright blue ribbon off the table. It was just long enough for several purposes, if Perry was any judge.
"My good lady, please take this with her compliments. You've been going to twice your usual work to feed us and tidy up after us. It's the least we can do," he said, presenting it to her stretched across his palms.
"Oh, my!"
Her cheeks took on a pleased blush, and Perry realized that his father had managed to pull out a ribbon that matched her eyes.
"Oh, I shouldn't."
"I insist," Mag said, draping it around her neck. "You've earned it."
One hand caressed the ribbon as she smiled.
"How did you know blue is my favorite color?"
"Trade secret," Mags replied. "Now, if you were planning on doing any wool work, I can particularly recommend this."
He picked up a skein of the Chira thread.
"It's much stronger than it looks, and it is extremely soft to the touch."
At this point, at least a dozen women and girls came around the strip of woodland that lay between Arvel's house and the palisade of the village. They were all chattering away like sparrows, and when they saw Mrs. Weaver there ahead of them, one of them called out,
"Now, Mina, don't you go snatching up all the bargains before we can get to them."
Then it was a very busy morning indeed. Everything had to be touched, examined, held up to the light, and set down again. Perry wasn't afraid that any of them would steal anything. For one thing, someone turning up in possession of a bauble or embroidering with thread everyone else knew she hadn't bought would be castigated. You just couldn't get away with stealing, not in a village this small, and definitely not with a herald living next door. But he was afraid one of those hanks of tiny glass beads would have a thread break, sending the beads scattering everywhere. But evidently, the thread they were strung on was sturdy stuff. A few of the women, who already knew exactly what they wanted, had come prepared with real coined money. So two lengths of fine linen, some bright linen embroidery thread, and a single hank of sparkling yellow glass beads were sold in short order. But the rest had to look and hear the prices, and ponder, and touch, and ponder, and ask whether
"That price can't come down after all,"
and ponder some more. Mags treated them all with the same friendly courtesy and patience. And
"I'll be back,"
they promised, one after another, and drifted back to the village. Perry could almost sense the thoughts buzzing in their heads like bees.
"They will be back," Mags said confidently. "Now they'll go see what they might have that I might want. That's where the real trading comes in."
Then he laughed and sat down on a stool he'd brought out from the house. Perry sat on the ground beside him.
"I'd have been damned good at this if I hadn't been chosen."
"I know. I've watched you in the shop," Perry agreed.
He was about to say more when a woman and a girl came into view. Perry had learned enough about the subtleties of clothing to know that the woman's gown was a step or two above that of the women who had been here earlier, while the girl's plainer outfit, and the fact that she was carrying a basket while the woman's hands were unburdened, marked her as the woman's servant. This must be the wife of the man who owned the biggest house in the village, who was probably also the village headman. Villages this small rarely had a mayor. Usually the wealthiest man, or, more rarely, woman, was appointed to speak for everyone.
"That is Una Miller. She is the miller's wife, and they have the big house in the village,"
Ryu told him, confirming his thoughts.
"Don't worry. She is nice."
"Hela, trader!"
Una called as soon as she was within earshot.
"You picked a fine morning to put out your wares."
Mags bowed with a little flourish.
"A fine morning it is, lady. I am Mags, and this young fellow is my son Perry. What can we assist you with?"
Una dimpled at him. Perry judged she was several years older than his mother, and her general expression was of someone who regards those around her as friends.
"Lady, indeed. I'm just the miller's wife, you rascal. You won't get the better of me in a bargain with flattery."
"I don't think I'd get the better of you in a bargain at all, dear lady," Mags replied, smiling.
She winked.
"Well, as for what you can assist me with, I require the materials for two wedding veils, which should be equal in quality but unalike. I hope you have good ideas, Trader Mags."
Mags picked up the finer of the two bolts of linen.
"To begin with, we'll have to have the fabric. This is called mist linen, I am told, and it is particularly well suited to veils.
Expertly, the woman ran her hand under the fabric and examined it.
Yes, this is perfect. Cut me two lengths of that, long enough to brush the floor behind and fall to below the chin in front. And let us go on to the materials for embellishing. I have two daughters, and, as I said, I want them to have equal veils, but not alike. Their colouring is like mine. What do you suggest?
Mags stroked his chin with his thumb and forefinger. Perry was really curious at this point just how his father was going to address this. He certainly wouldn't know how to decorate a wedding veil.
I would suggest these for your older daughter.
He pulled out three hanks of embroidery thread in shades of red, a deep red the color of wine, a dark rust, and a slightly lighter rust color. Embroider the veil's edge with flowers in these colors. Then use these yellow beads as the center of each flower. He plucked out a hank of the tiny glass beads in a deep gold and laid it on the thread in Una's hand.
The beads will sparkle in the light, and they'll weigh the edge of the veil down enough that it won't blow off her head. And for the younger daughter,
he pulled out three hanks of thread in three shades of green,
a scrolling of leaves and vines, and these transparent green beads to represent buds.
Una stared up at him with amused astonishment.
Well, traitor, I will say that you know your wares better than any fellow I have seen out here before. And that is a perfect suggestion. Have you enough of each dye lot for the entire veil?
For answer, Mags whistled at Perry, who moved quickly and took the six hanks of thread.
Five of each, not counting the ones you have now, Mags ordered.
Perry hopped into the back of the cavern and matched the thread with the ones in the storage and brought them all back out. While he'd been hunting, his father had cut two lengths of the mist linen to Una's satisfaction.
30 skeins of thread, 6 hanks of beads, and 2 lengths of linen, said Mags, expertly folding the linen and packaging the thread in beads.
It all made a surprisingly small bundle.
Now, shall we discuss price?
Mags had seen his father at work in the shop before, so he knew the delicate dance going on here between merchant and customer. Though in Mags's case, he never actually had to worry about making a profit, so his nonchalance didn't have to be feigned. His earlier bargaining with the women who had paid in cash had told him what the traffic out here would bear. Now he just had to strike a bargain where Una would be satisfied she wasn't being taken advantage of, and had gotten a sliver of an edge over him, but was not suspicious that she had gotten too good a bargain. When it was all over with, and they had agreed on a price, Una fished in her belt purse and pulled out the requisite handful of coppers and a lone silver piece. And when she had picked up the package to hand to her servant girl, Mags pulled a ribbon the color of the dark red, another the color of the dark green, and a lovely dark blue and laid them over the top of the bundle, much to Una's surprise.
A little wedding gift from me, whenever the weddings may be, he said with a twinkle.
Una laughed and thanked him.
Not until the veils are finished, at least, she added. And the wedding gowns? That will keep them out of mischief. Thank you, Trader Max. It was good bargaining with you.
And with you, Una Miller, he replied easily. I am also open to trade in small portable objects, should you desire something for yourself.
I'll consider that.
She called over her shoulder, and trailed by her servant, she made her way back to Withern.
Lydia taught me a lot about fabrics and colors when I was roughly your age, Mags said, leaning against the caravan. A couple of Dia's handmaidens helped me out by teaching me how to estimate how much thread it takes to embroider something. And I'm good at memorizing, so I spent a couple of days with a merchant who sells this sort of thing down in Haven, learning what things should cost.
Perry nodded. His father continued.
The big thing will be trying to figure out even trades. You'd probably better leave that to me, unless something springs out at you, as obvious.
Over the course of the morning, other women and girls turned up, looked, and said they would be back. They sold nothing but a few ribbons, some pins and needles, and one string of blue glass beads suitable for a necklace. Mags seemed content, so Perry assumed this was exactly as he had planned for the day to go. Mrs. Weaver brought them something to eat at noon, and Arvel wandered by and kept them company for a while. Then, just before supper, the men began to turn up. As the first of them rounded the trees, Mags straightened up.
Ah, now things are going to get serious, he told Perry. Watch.
And Perry did watch, carefully. Within moments, it was clear why the men of the village were here. They were looking for presents for their wives. They were here to find out what exactly Mags was willing to trade for. And they were bound and determined this slick trader wasn't going to get the best of them. The men gathered around Mags, and one by one they made their cases. The first, who offered